Chance out of New York City. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. On Monday, October 1st, 2012, I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday, live at our new times from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24-7 on drsaputo.com and prn.fm.
Today you're going to hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 22 the hour. And we've got another really good show for you today that's going to include, what are we eating that's the same as alcohol but doesn't give you the buzz?
And can you treat depression with NSAIDs?
And how about a delicious solution to lower the risk of gout?
Should doctors follow science or their gut feelings?
And a natural treatment for Alzheimer's disease.
You know, if you'd like to join our conversation and have questions about our topics or your health, give us a call on Mondays from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time or 10 to 11 Eastern Time on PRN.FM at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Lots of eights in there.
Well, the lucky eights, huh?
Well, there continues to be controversy about the dangers of high fructose corn syrup. And, of course, the Corn Refiners Association and the American Medical Association say it's safe and the same as table sugar. But scientific research doesn't agree, and studies are showing that high fructose corn syrup and sugar are causing non-alcoholic fatty liver disease in 10% of our teenagers. So is there a difference between table sugar, which is also referred to as sucrose, and high fructose corn syrup, and between glucose and fructose?
Boy, you asked the really important questions here, because I think a lot of people are confused about high fructose corn syrup and sucrose, which is table sugar, and of course the difference between fructose and glucose. So here's the skinny on it, okay? It's pretty straightforward. Regular table sugar is sucrose, and it's made of two simple sugars. One sugar is fructose and the other is glucose, and they act quite differently, and we'll get to that part in just a minute. Now, when you look at high fructose corn syrup, it's the same thing. It's made of glucose and it's made of fructose. Now, the slight difference between the two is that in the case of high fructose corn syrup, there's probably a little bit more fructose, maybe as much as 55% instead of the 50% that's in table sugar. And in addition, the two molecules of glucose and fructose are connected to one another to make a kind of like a double sugar instead of two single sugars.
In which one?
In the one that is the table sugar. It's got a double sugar. It's connected together. There's a chemical bond holding the glucose and the fructose together, whereas the high fructose corn syrup, there's simple sugars that are separate. Now, can that make a difference in the way the body handles it? A lot of people think yes, that there is a difference, and there's some interesting studies. One in particular was some studies on mice. What did that show, Vicki?
Well, actually, this study that was done on rats, it was with high fructose corn syrup, and the fats that ate the same amount of calories.
The mice that ate the same amount of calories.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
They didn't get fat, but the ones in the high fructose corn syrup got fat, three times as fat.
All right, so the difference was that the rats that took in the high fructose corn syrup rather than the table sugar gained weight even though they had the same number of calories. That's a big statement to make.
Yeah, and especially three times as fat.
Right, so that's telling you there's something different going on here. Yet at the same time, when you talk to the top people in biochemistry that are MDs in this country, they're saying there really isn't much difference between the way the body handles it, either one of these products.
Yeah, but a lot of studies are showing that it really does.
I think that's
right. And fructose damages the liver and...
Well, now we're talking about a different topic. We're talking about fructose and glucose, okay? Not the difference between high fructose corn syrup and sucrose. So... The way we make up high fructose corn syrup and the way we make up table sugar is with these two simple sugars, fructose and glucose. They are very different in the way the body handles them. Glucose, for example, goes to the liver and only about 20% of it is metabolized there. The rest is used for energy, or it's stored, okay, as in the form of glycogen. And glycogen is what's stored in our muscles and our liver to give us that quick energy when we need it. So that's how glucose works. Now, fructose, when it gets to the liver, it works like alcohol. It works like booze. The ethanol that's in alcohol is processed by the liver just like fructose is. It's transformed into a lot of fat. And these fats, which are free fatty acids and what are called LDL cholesterol, that's very high density and dangerous for the body, are what are formed. When they get into the liver, what they do is they cause inflammation. So the presence of these fats that are converted from alcohol and fructose go into the liver, inflame it, cause a fatty liver, and eventually result in cirrhosis. So if you took a can of beer and you had a can of soda for your kids, and they took it, it would be the same effect on the body in terms of what it does to the liver to cause alcoholic or non-alcoholic fatty liver disease that leads to cirrhosis. It's amazing.
Well, not only that, they found that fructose increases the appetite, and it also turns into fat.
Yeah, well, that's right. So the effects of fructose on the body in the liver we talked about, what we didn't talk about is it also gets converted into uric acid as another byproduct.
Which can lead to gout.
Exactly, gout and hypertension. So we've got another problem there. Now, the effect of fructose on the brain is another story, because it basically is working on a hormone called leptin. And leptin is made by our fat cells.
And that regulates our appetite.
Exactly. So if we've got leptin working right, meaning that we're eating our meal and we're towards the end of the meal, our fat cells will secrete leptin. The leptin will go to the brain. It'll turn off those sections. It'll turn off the leptin, so it doesn't work very well. And the brain won't respond to it, so you'll think you're still hungry. As opposed to glucose, which does quite the reverse. It tells you you're full. So the difference between glucose and fructose is huge.
Well, I think that it's important for people to understand a little bit about the liver, too, to know why it's so important to have a healthy liver, because our liver regulates our blood sugar and our cholesterol, and it burns fat, it metabolizes our hormones, it stores vitamin A, and most importantly, it detoxifies all these toxins and things that are in our body that we want to get rid of.
Okay.
So we really need our liver.
All right, so that's the value of the liver in this setting. The other thing that you have to keep in mind that fructose does is it leads to metabolic syndrome. And some of it's because it causes this rise in fats, these triglycerides and very low density lipoproteins in the liver. And that leads to the inflammation and cirrhosis, but also leads to the metabolic syndrome, heart attacks, strokes, insulin resistance, and of course all these effects it has on hypertension. To cause hypertension.
You can also get hepatitis from it.
Well, it's a non-infectious hepatitis. It's a chemical hepatitis.
But it's still a hepatitis.
Well, it's an inflamed liver is what that means. What I don't want people to do is get confused that it might be viral hepatitis, because that's a totally different topic.
I also know that it can lead to cancer.
Well, eventually, that's right. It can lead to cancer.
So we don't want this non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. We don't want any kind of liver disease. And we need to try to get our kids and ourselves off of all this sugar and high fructose corn syrup. But the thing is that it's very difficult to avoid it. They sneak it into so many foods, like our processed foods and dressings and sauces and cereals and breads. We already know that we get high fructose corn syrup and sugars in soda and candy, but we really need to be more aware of it, because Americans are eating something like 150 pounds of it a year. About 60 of those pounds are from high fructose corn syrup, which is higher and is bound differently than the table sugar. And a lot of scientists, like we just said, think that it's pretty dangerous. So I think if we look at sugar like it's a poison, it might help us to avoid it. The FDA says that it's safe, and they subsidize the corn industry, high fructose corn syrup. So we need to make some decisions for ourselves and try to stay away from this.
Well, that's really solid advice, Vicki. And so, I mean, the bottom line of what we're talking here is that sugar in general is bad for us. There's no question whether you take it in the form of table sugar or you take it in the form of high fructose corn syrup. And if you stick around long enough, the high fructose corn industry is going to be putting out, it looks like, something called crystalline fructose, which means it's 100% fructose. Now, this is all different than what Mother Nature does. Mother Nature puts sugar in, or it puts actually fructose in fruit. And the fruit has both the fructose, which is the poison, but it has the antidote in it as well, which is the fiber and all the other things that are in the fruit itself that protect you against the form of fructose by itself in its pure state. So it's interesting how this happens and how we get into trouble with things because things get out of hand. When we started making sugar because we knew how and it wasn't all that expensive, we started increasing our consumption from 5 or 6 pounds a year of sugar maybe 100 years ago to this number that Vicki's telling you about. And then we got to find out that we could make this sugar in a much less expensive way by refining corn to make high fructose corn syrup. That's what the industry did. And of course, it makes a lot of sense. You wouldn't blame them for doing that because it gives you a competitive advantage from the point of view of cost. But it also does all this other stuff that we've been talking about that causes lots of problems. So we have to now wake up to what's happened and stop what's turning out to be a moving train, which is the high fructose corn syrup industry, which is now dependent on being able to make more of this product, and they want to sell as much of it as they possibly can so that we'll have they'll make as much money as they can, because let's face it, that's what business is all about. It's about return on investment.
Well, fructose is sweeter also than table sugar, so I guess they probably don't need to. I don't know. Everybody's gotten so used to eating things that are sweet, it's become addictive.
Well, it's less expensive. I think that's the main thing. And yes, it is addictive, and it depends on what kind of sugar you take in, because or what kind of sweet things you take in, because different sweet things do different things to your body. And that's why the fructose problem is a huge one.
You know, there's a lot of talk about how, you know, school programs need to promote healthy food and exercise and weight loss and all this kind of thing. And in some ways, it's almost like blaming the kids, saying, you know, well, it's your fault because you're not eating right and you're not exercising enough and all that. Well, those things are really important to do. However, we need to get this poison out of all of our food when it's not necessary. We don't need to add a little bit more sugar in our salad dressing and in all these different foods that we eat and our bread.
Even our meat is often mixed with high fructose corn syrup because it's less expensive than the meat is. It makes it more addictive, okay? The taste is more addicting, and we tend to just eat what tastes good. And you can't blame your kids for that. You can blame us after we know about this for that problem, because now that we're aware of it, we're the ones that should be the responsible ones to change what we feed our kids in school. You know, we had a project in Walnut Creek that is still going on that is called the Walnut Creek Wellness City Challenge. It's in a little town in Northern California. They got tired of seeing what was happening to the school lunches. And so we got together with a lot of professional people, about 25 people from professions locally, with doctors and scientists and administrators and people like that, and came up with a program that we thought was really good for school lunches. And one, of course, is no sugar, no high fructose corn syrup, unless you want to call it a dessert. And then you don't want to have a whole lot of dessert for lunch. You want to have a good solid meal for lunch. No trans fat of any kind. And make sure there's enough fiber. Now we're talking about creating something that's more like fruit because it's got the fiber in it as well. And, of course, that's less of a dangerous problem. So this program is working pretty well out here. We're making some changes in what the kids eat. And what they eat makes a huge difference. I mean, you feed kids the wrong things, their bodies just don't do well.
And there's so much emphasis, you know, on trying to stay away from fat because it's fattening, and mm-hmm. people think that that's what's making them fat. Well, sure, if you eat enough fat, it's going to make you fat, but sugar is worse for making you gain all this weight and getting fat. It's the fructose. Remember we were talking about that? So a lot of these foods that say they're low fat, that just means that they've added more sugar. And the other thing is, or fructose, high fructose corn syrup, and I lost my train of thought.
Okay. Well, that's right. And so we have to get away from that and get back to trying to feed the population food that's healthy. If we feed people food that's not healthy, the kinds of things we talked about here are exactly what's happening in the world today. And it's not just here. It's all over the world because the consumption of sugar and high fructose corn syrup is just enormous. The fat phobia, which is what you were talking about, that this country has, is a problem because fats are actually our primary fuel. Now, you don't want to eat trans fats because they're dangerous. And you want to make sure that you get enough of the essential fatty acids because they're absolutely essential for life. So things like flaxseed oil and fish oil that have the omega-3 and 6 fats are important, and they should come from healthy sources. You've got to be careful where you get them, or you get ones that aren't healthy. So that's important, and a certain amount of saturated fat is absolutely necessary, whether it comes from things like high-grade coconut oil or it comes from animal fat.
Well, what I was going to say, though, before we finish up on the fat part, is about the sugar. It's a lot of people, when they think, okay, I'll avoid the high fructose corn syrup and I'll avoid the sugar and I'll just take an artificial sweetener.
Yeah, well, that's
but the artificial sweeteners are worse than eating the sugar. And a lot of those increase your appetite. So it's everything in life, you know, is about balance, a little bit of this or a little bit of that. But it's just being totally overdone, and like we said, it's being sneaked into so many foods.
So we have to train our kids. I mean, it's about that simple. All right, so you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. We're opening up the lines at 888-874-4888. So give us a call if you have a question about your health or what we're discussing. And now it's time for Vicki's first 2020 tip on how great is Mother Nature. And we'll be right back with, can depression be treated with NSAIDs? Are you kidding me?
Well, how great is Mother Nature? You know, as I talk about eggs, think of the number 7 and its multiples. For example, the eggs of a potato bug hatch in 7 days. Those of a canary in 14 days, and those of the barnyard hen in 21 days. The eggs of ducks and geese hatch in 28 days, and also the mallard in 35 days. The eggs of the parrot and the ostrich, those hatch in 42 days, and they're all divisible by 7, the number of days in the week. You know, God's wisdom is seen in the making of an elephant, the 4 legs of this great beast all bend forward in the same direction. There's no other 4-legged animal that's made this way, and God planned that this animal would have a huge body too large to live on 2 legs. So for this reason, he gave it 4 fulcrums so it can rise from the ground easily. Now, the horse rises from the ground on its 2 front legs first, and a cow rises from the ground with its 2 hind legs first.
It's complicated, doesn't it? Amazing how it fits together.
Well, you know, God's wisdom is revealed also in his arrangement of sections and segments, as well as in the number of grains. Each watermelon has an even number of stripes on the rind. Each orange has an even number of segments. Each ear of corn has an even number of rows, and each stalk of wheat has an even number of grains. Every bunch of bananas has on its largest row an even number of bananas, and each row decreases by 1, so that 1 row has an even number and the next row an odd number.
That's amazing.
This is another thing that I thought was really interesting, is that the waves of the sea roll in on the shore 26 to the minute in all kinds of weather. And all grains are found in even numbers on the stalks. And the flowers blossom at certain specified times during the day. Linnaeus, the great botanist, once said that if he had a conservatory containing the right kind of soil, moisture, and temperature, he'd tell the time of day or night by the flowers that were open and those that were closed. You know, we can't outdo the perfection of nature, and yet we keep trying to with the genetically engineered foods, the pesticides, the herbicides, the pollution, the heavy metals, the chemicals, and all the other toxins that are in our environment. So remember, nature bats last. Respect it.
You got a good point there. You know, there's another kind of interesting parallel to this. It's called sacred geometry. Some of the work of Melchizedek, for example, explains that. And it may be that there's organization that is absolutely phenomenal that goes from the universal side to the microscopic size of what's happening in the universe. And all these things that you're talking about, Vicki, just tell us and how complicated Mother Nature is and how we should be respecting it if we don't understand it. Because as soon as we make changes, what happens is that we start to get into trouble. And that's why we've gotten into trouble in the practice of medicine, where we're doing all these things, particularly with pharmaceutical drugs and technologies, but especially pharmaceutical drugs. So it's a huge issue for us to kind of like pay more attention to Mother Nature, not do so many invasive things that change things, and see what we can do to get along with her rather than fight what's happening. Okay.
Chronic inflammation is the most common cause of disease. And here's an article that's kind of, well, it's trying to relate it to depression. But first, let's talk about when inflammation can be beneficial and when it can be harmful.
Okay, well, I mean, when we're looking at inflammation, if we don't have it to start with, we're dead. Because our bodies respond to infections and to other kinds of problems in our body with a process called inflammation. And what happens is there's a call out to white cells and other kinds of cells to come to the area where the injury of the body is. We have all kinds of immune activation that occurs that makes our bodies able to fight the defenses of what's going on. So we must have inflammation. It's a good thing. The problem is when we start doing things to people with the chemicals that we add that are new, that have never been in a body before, so there's a lot of toxicity, and we don't take care of ourselves because we don't eat right or sleep right or do the things that we should be doing, is that things go awry. And in that setting, what happens is we get something called chronic inflammation, meaning long-standing inflammation that the body can't do much to protect itself against. And so what happens is we are inflamed, we have autoimmune diseases, cancer, and a lot of other problems.
Well, when you have this short-term inflammation, like just for example, say you get a virus, sometimes your body needs to have that fever to help you to get over it.
Well, fever is part of the inflammatory process,
okay,
that's right.
What I'm trying to say is that people are too quick to take aspirin or Tylenol to reduce their fever or NSAIDs, and sometimes it's okay to have a little fever because it's part of the healing process. But then, like you said, with this chronic inflammation, when people have problems in their joints or their arteries or their brain or whatever, this is what can lead to serious disease and problems. But anyway, this article was talking about when we feel depressed, Well, what they're trying to do is to promote taking non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs for depression.
Or even ones that are more powerful than that.
When we're depressed, is it because we're sick or is it because we're unhappy about being sick?
Well, it's interesting how things can get carried away. I mean, when we're looking at inflammation and noticing that people who are depressed have high levels of inflammatory markers, does that mean that this is a biochemical disease, a disorder, that's the primary cause of what's happened? And the answer is absolutely not. It doesn't necessarily mean that, but these people who are doing this study have come up with the concept that they think that it might be, and so they're raising the question about what can we do that might be able to reverse depression that's biochemical. Now, this feeds right into the hands of what? The pharmaceutical industry, and try to call this a biochemical disease that we can reverse by playing with neurotransmitters, which is what we do with the SSRI antidepressants, or we can play with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or drugs even more powerful than that.
Well, this was a study that was done at Emory University, but they didn't say who funded it.
And well, that's right.
They were mentioning one drug in particular, the Remicade.
Now you're talking about something that's really powerful and dangerous and should be used with great restraint, because you're talking about a drug that over 5 years has a mortality rate of 3.5%, which means that one person in 33 will die from it at the end of 5 years if they're still on the drug. You really want to start looking in that direction with a drug that's powerful? I mean, if this isn't backed by a pharmaceutical company, I will eat my hat, because it just has the smell of that all over the place.
And, you know, well, first of all, let's talk about what cytokines are, because they were talking about how that was associated with depression.
Well, that's just another way of explaining some of the biochemistry that occurs in depression, and people got all mixed up. Now, cytokines are chemical messengers like hormones are, that go from one cell to another, that transmit information about what's happening in the body. So the cytokine levels of certain kinds of chemicals go up when you have depression caused by anything, whether it's a physical cause or it's an emotional cause. But keep in mind, if you've got an emotional cause for your depression, which most people do, I mean, I'd have to say at least 80% of the depression we see would be associated with people who have emotional challenges, not physical disability as the primary thing. And if you think you're going to solve that problem by fighting inflammation, you're on the wrong track. It's sort of like putting a Band-Aid over things and covering it so you can't see it, and then thinking that you fixed the problem because you may have helped the symptoms a little tiny bit. It's the same thing with the SSRI antidepressants. It's a big disaster to try and use SSRIs to modify neurotransmitter levels to make you feel better, when what you're really trying to do is solve the problem, which is caused by dysfunctional issues in your own life.
Another thing I think to be aware of is that there are natural anti-inflammatories that have been found to boost the mood, and that's curcumin. That's something that you can do, and also just living a healthy lifestyle.
Well, that's another thing you could consider. It's in the same ballpark of what we're talking about, and it certainly would be safer. But I think what we need to do is deal with the underlying cause. It's what we don't do in medicine. We treat the symptoms. We need to start treating causes. It's time for our PRN.FM station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The lines are open at 888-874-4888. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be talking about a delicious solution to lower the risk of gout, and we've got some calls waiting. We'll tend to those as well. So stay tuned. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Gout is a type of debilitating inflammatory arthritis that causes excruciating pain. And the good news is that something delicious can lower the risk of recurrent gout attacks. Let's talk about what gout is and its cause and associations.
All right. Gout is a biochemical defect in people, for the most part, in the production of uric acid. So uric acid is the end product of the metabolism of purines. And what does that mean? Purines are a kind of biochemical reactions that result in the production of uric acid from the breakdown of these compounds that are found in DNA and RNA and in our energy-producing system called ATP. And when we have a genetic defect that makes a lot of uric acid, it gets concentrated and it causes problems in the body in three places. One is in the big toe. The classic picture of someone with gout is a older man who is overweight, that's got a glass of wine in his hand and has a big red toe, and it's really tender. So when the uric acid gets into that joint and it's present, what happens is it causes an inflammatory reaction, and the body suffers with a lot of pain. That's one thing that goes wrong in gout. The second thing is that a lot of uric acid is in the urine because it's being produced in large amounts, and it can crystallize in the urine and cause kidney stones. So we can get these uric acid kidney stones that those of you that have had them know how painful they can be. The third thing that happens is that uric acid can concentrate in the kidney itself and actually cause kidney failure. You can have a problem with severe kidney failure if there's enough uric acid that's in that particular area. So that's the story of what gout is.
Also, you know, you're mentioning the man sitting with a glass of wine and
big toe, and he's overweight.
Also, he could have high blood pressure and diabetes. And I think it's a...
those are often associated with it, that's right.
As well as some of the medications can lead to that. And earlier we talked about fructose.
Fructose is one of the things, you're right, that makes a lot of uric acid. And it's one of the causes in our community because we're taking in 150 pounds of sugar, whether it's high fructose corn syrup or just table sugar, a year. And that makes a lot of uric acid, and so we're seeing a lot more in the way of gout these days because of that.
Another culprit are diuretics. Explain that one.
Yeah, the thiazide diuretics and the loop diuretics. So things like hydrochlorothiazide and Lasix are probably the ones that are the highest offenders. They cause an increase in the production of uric acid that can be massive. In fact, gout in a woman is as rare as a hen's tooth. It's really uncommon. And the only way that we see it is if the body is pressured into making more uric acid, either because we're not excreting it right or we're making more of it. And thiazide diuretics are a real common cause of that. The other common cause of that would be cancers, because cancers have a turnover of more DNA and RNA, and that produces a lot more uric acid as well.
Well, you know, you were saying it was so rare in women, but more people are starting to get gout from lifestyle. One of the things is the fructose, but gout affects over 8.3 million adults just in the U.S. every year.
That's right. Well,
and the attacks are often recurrent, so we need to do something about that. And what we started out saying is that there's something delicious that can lower your risk of these recurrent attacks, and that's cherries. Yeah. And all you need to eat are 12 cherries. And if they're not in season, that's not a good enough excuse, because you can get them frozen and dehydrated. You can get, and those are really good, those dried cherries. You can sprinkle them in all kinds of food and use them in baking and everything. And the juice, cherry juice, is delicious, and you can use the concentrate and the extract. So there's really no excuse for not being able to include cherries in your diet, and it reduces the risk 35%. And if you're taking the allopurinol, which is the drug of choice for preventing these recurrent attacks, and you eat cherries with that, it reduces your risk 75%.
Yeah, so it's something you could consider. Now, where do we get this information? There was an article published in a journal called Arthritis and Rheumatism in September, of this year, 2012. They had 633 patients with gout that they followed for a year. And one of the things they did is they did a questionnaire and asked them, how much in the way of cherry products had you taken for the 2 days prior to your attack? And what they found out is that those people who were taking that the couple of days before the attack seemed not to have a problem. The people who were taking the cherry products didn't have an attack nearly as often as people who weren't on it for those 2 days prior to the time the attack came on. And they found that up to two or three servings of cherries caused a reduction in the number of attacks in a linear way, but taking more than two or three servings didn't have any benefit. So it's something that's semi-practical. I think consuming more cherries is a good idea.
Well, you also need to limit your meat and gravy, especially organ meats, and limit your alcohol. Saturated fat lowers your ability to eliminate the uric acid. Limit your fructose, choose complex carbohydrates, low dairy, and drink a lot of water.
All right, so that tells the story, and it's time for Vicki's 2020 tips. So you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Len Sabuti here with Nurse Vicki. And it's time for Vicki's final 2020 tip on why is it better to shop alone? And we'll come back with, should doctors follow science or their gut feelings? And we have a natural approach to treating Alzheimer's disease we want to share with you. So stay tuned.
I have some tips on what to do while you're shopping if you're forced to tag along with your spouse and you're bored.
Well, we need tips to that. You know, we guys that go shopping with you have a hard time sometimes. It gets a little bit boring for us, so we have to entertain ourselves. So what did you come up with?
Well, after Mr. Samuel retired, his wife insisted that he accompany her on trips to Target.
Oh, jeez.
And unfortunately, like most men, he found shopping boring and he preferred to get in and out. So equally unfortunate, his wife, like most women, loved to browse. So yesterday, his dear wife received a letter from the local Target store. Dear Mrs. Samuel, over the past 6 months, your husband has caused quite a commotion in our store. We cannot tolerate this behavior, and we've been forced to ban both of you from the store. Our complaints against your husband, Mr. Samuel, are listed, and you are documented by our video surveillance cameras. So this letter lists the dates, but I'm going to skip the dates. So on the first date, he took boxes of condoms and he randomly put them in other people's carts when they weren't looking.
That's creative.
And then another day, he set all the alarm clocks in the housewares to go off at 5-minute intervals. He made a trail of tomato juice on the floor leading to the women's restroom.
Oh, my goodness.
And then the next month, he set up a tent in the camping department, and he told the children shoppers that he'd invite them in only if they would bring pillows and blankets from the bedding department, in which 20 children obliged. And then the next week, he looked right into the security camera, and he used it as a mirror while he picked his nose.
Oh, my gosh.
When he was in the gun department handling the guns, he asked the clerk where the antidepressants were. On another day, he hid in a clothing rack, and when people browsed through, he yelled, "Pick me! Pick me!" When an announcement came over the loudspeaker, he assumed a fetal position, and he screamed, "Oh, no, it's those voices again!" And then he went into a fitting room, shut the door, and waited a while, and then he yelled very loudly, "Hey, there's no toilet paper in here!"
This guy is creative.
Well, you know, so much for togetherness after retirement. Well, personally, I'd rather shop alone anyway. People need a purpose in life, you know. It's important in a healthy lifestyle, just as exercise and diet and sleep and stress reduction. I mean, look what it did to her and to the store. And what happened to him, Mr. Samuel, when he was bored? I mean, at least he has a sense of humor more than you can say for Target. And I think he cured Mrs. Samuel from insisting that he'd tag along, but what does he do at home if she leaves him alone?
Well, I think you have to keep him occupied with something he likes.
Yeah, maybe he needs a job. I've seen older men having jobs, like driving shuttles and, you know, things
well,
like that.
Well, is there some reason why we have to stop working because we get to 65 or more? I mean, that's probably some of the most creative time we have in our life. Shopping is certainly not one of the more creative things that interests me. So I'm glad that you told us this tip, because now I'm armed and dangerous next time we go to Target.
Well, I'm not taking you shopping anyway.
Thank you. That was a circuitous way of getting there. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health, and the number is 888-874-4888.
So do you trust your intuition? Education and experience along with intuition should not be ignored, and a study shows that a doctor's gut feeling warrants taking action. According to research, doctors who experience their gut feelings about a serious illness in children should take action on the feeling and not ignore it. But, you know, I was wondering how insurance companies are going to respond to this with all their rules.
You know, they probably wouldn't even know. If a doctor has an intuitive feeling that somebody has an illness, what he does is, or she does is just, they do a workup and they evaluate it to see, does this kid really have that problem or does this person have that problem? So I don't see that as a big problem, but I understand your concern because HMR medicine.
Well, they start ordering tests on their gut feeling.
Yeah, well, that's right. It could be an issue, and with you got a really good point, because if we order tests that we can't justify based on what we think this person has, then they don't reimburse for it. Then the hospital gets on you because they're going to absorb the cost, and eventually you may lose your job if you start ordering things that are really...
I'm like, well, what do you mean this patient looked pale, or what do you mean that this patient's breath...
Well, it could get that way. You know, it's not like it was 30 years ago or 40 years ago when you had the ability as a physician to take a workup any place that you want. And a lot of the time you found things that kind of surprised you. And it's this interest of staying connected to your patient that's really so important. But let's take a look at what's happening when you get information that's not just in a lab test or is just outright obvious. There are lots of ways. There are smells. There are sights. There are sounds that occur with people who have certain conditions that give us information that are not written in textbooks. I know we used to play a little bit of a game when I was a chief resident in internal medicine at my hospital where I was training, where we'd go to the door of the patient's room and just look inside and see if we could make the diagnosis without going inside or asking any questions. You'd be surprised how often, judging from what the patient looked like, what the smell of the room was like, the appearance of what you saw could tell you exactly what the diagnosis was. And when you get an intuitive feeling, where does that come from? It doesn't come from a textbook.
Well, have you ever had an intuitive feeling like that where you diagnosed a patient that way?
Absolutely. I just get this eerie feeling like there's something going on here, and I don't know what it is exactly, but we've got to do more than what we're doing because this person is slipping away.
Tell the story about Mike.
Well, this is a person who is actually a family member, one of my brothers, who was having recurring episodes of chest pain, and we worked him up for heart disease, and he didn't have any kind of problem with that at all. Everything was normal. He had the cleanest arteries you ever saw. But on one occasion, he got up in the morning, was really weak, passed out, and couldn't get up, was having a hard time. They called an ambulance, took him to the emergency room, and what they found is that his heart rate had dropped to about 30, and he was having chest pain at the same time. So they did the usual workup for heart attack, which, again, he didn't have, and they wound up putting a pacemaker in. And when they put the pacemaker in, they put it in through the left arm, but he had a popped lung on the right side, and there was no way to explain that, and nobody figured that out. And I got this funny feeling like, this has got to be something that's different than what they think. And then out of nowhere, knowledge came to me about, yes, my dad had something similar to that as well and was never diagnosed. He was having recurring episodes of chest pain that weren't related to heart disease. And what turned out and popped into my head then, and God knows why, is familial Mediterranean fever. And I'm going, what?
Where did that come from?
I haven't thought about that in probably 30 years. I've never seen a case of it. Or even heard of anybody else having a case of it. But when that popped in my head, I thought, oh, that does make sense. Where did that come from? Where did that gut feeling come from? And then we did the workup for it. Sure enough, it's what he's got.
And you blew all the other doctors away because nobody had thought of that.
No, even when it happened, they thought, what? What? They didn't even know what it was. They had to go back and look it up in the textbook. And, of course, I'd reviewed it and read it one time, maybe, as a medical student, and there was that information there. Where did that intuitive feeling come from? Amazing, huh?
Well, also, share the story about Carol.
Another interesting story, a woman I'd never seen before. I was called by a naturopath, and they said, this person has a fast heart rate, and I think it's a medical problem. I don't think I should be dealing with it. And I had a very busy day. I wasn't really prepared to see this person because it was going to screw up my schedule, and I thought, okay, I'll do it. And so we crammed this person in, and when she came in, I could see that she had atrial fibrillation, and the rate was a little bit high, and she didn't look that good, and I didn't know what to make of it.
And she was only in her 30s.
Right. And so I thought, well, let's just use the hospital and see what happens, and we'll start her on the medications that she should have to fight this condition.
Well, you rushed her over to the hospital.
Well, I went over with her. I don't know why I did that, but I decided to do that. And later that night, she had a code, okay? And the cardiologist that was on call got this intuitive feeling in his mind that this could be a tumor in the left atrium. I call it an atrial myxoma. Where did that come from? Yes, they're rare as a hen's tooth, and he'd never seen one before in his practice, but it pops in his head. And it turns out when they do the test that, yes, it's exactly what she's got. They take her to surgery, and for 5 days, she's in a coma, but she recovers. Now, where does all this information come from? How do we get the idea that there's something impending that's a little bit different? Is that intuition that comes from within us? Is that something that comes outside of us? Is there a role of spirit in the practice of medicine that connects you with things like that?
Well, I know I was praying for her.
Oh, yeah.
I was working at your office that day when she came in, and when I heard how sick she was, I was praying for her.
Well, there's another story that really interested me more than these two, and this I saw on the Internet.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
It was a story of a man, I guess he looked like he was probably in his 50s or 60s, who had a heart attack, and they rushed him to the emergency room, and they tried to resuscitate him, and after 30 minutes of resuscitation, they called it a day and said, this guy's legally dead, and they pronounced him dead. And the cardiologist that was there left, and as he left, he got this thing in his mind and said, resuscitate him one more time, resuscitate him one more time. He thought, that's nonsense, I'm not going to listen to this. And the voice kept coming back in his head saying, do it one more time and pray. And he finally stopped and said, well, why shouldn't I do that? You know, it's a bit odd to do it, but why shouldn't I do that? So he went back. And this person's there dead, and there's still another doctor that's there, and he says, let's shock this patient one more time.
The other doctor looked at him like he was crazy.
Yeah, he said, well, the guy's dead. I mean, don't you know when to stop? And he said, just please for me. You know me. Please for me. I've got this deep feeling that it's going to help him. He says, okay, I'll put up with your nonsense. And he shocked him one more time, and the guy woke up. Unbelievable. What motivated that man to do it? Where did that voice in his head come from? Is that his intuition again? What is intuition? Is it something that comes from the outside of us or from the inside of us? Is it our connection with spirit? Is it the universal force? Is it Mother Nature? Is it God? What is it? But it's a powerful tool that I think we have to hold in reserve and honor. And this study that was done on kids showed that intuition helped a lot of kids who wouldn't have done very well if that doctor hadn't acted on his or her intuition.
And the diagnostic power of the gut feeling was the same in the experienced and the non-experienced clinicians.
So that tells you something more. So it's not just the length of time you've been in medicine. It's information that's coming from someplace that's hard to understand. There are a lot of things that happen in life and in medicine that are really kind of almost overwhelming because they're so different from what we expect in our usual life. I mean, why did you and I, Vicki, why were we able to walk on 2,000-degree coals? And what led us to actually even be there to do it in the first place? Because it sounds like insanity. And yet, in our bare feet, we did that back in 1986, and that was a life shift for both of us as we recognized that we could do things that we would regard as superhuman. Where did that come from? And why did we do it? And did it have an effect on us that changed our lives? The answer is absolutely yes. So we have to be respectful of these pieces of information, of these connections we have with something out there that is part of who we are. And maybe that's when we start looking at unity as opposed to duality. in unity, the world and the universe is all one thing and we're part of it, an inseparable part of it? Or are we this duality where we're separate from it and living a competitive adversarial life where we're worried about ourselves and nobody else? Well, these are questions to ponder. I suggest that it's our next big move in evolution to become a community of people that are connected to one another, and we're caring about ourselves more than we're caring about, or less than we're caring about everybody else. We put ourselves in a secondary position. That's a beautiful way to live together, to love and support and connect and identify with and have it be important that your neighbor is doing well and it's not just you and your own family. All these things are connected. What these wonderful doctors found in this British Medical Journal article that was published in this month. A nice story, huh?
Well, melatonin is big in the news again this week for a couple different reasons. There were a couple different articles on it. Melatonin is the hormone, you know, that helps us to sleep at night when it's dark, which is why it's not helpful to turn on the bright lights just before you go to bed or when you get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom.
Right.
And frequently people take it for jet lag to help them, you know, get back into their usual circadian rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
But 20 million people in the U.S. are on beta blockers. These are drugs that are for cardiovascular disease and for high blood pressure, and sometimes people take them when they're anxious.
Yeah, they often don't sleep well.
And we've been pretty critical of people taking it for general insomnia because it's playing with our endocrine system and it's the unknown. But now there are some new studies that are touting the benefits of melatonin if a person has beta blocker insomnia. And the good thing about it is that there really aren't any side effects or rebound insomnia when you take it this way. But what do you think about this latest talk of giving melatonin for just insomnia for people across the board that are over 55?
Yeah.
Giving it to autistic and mentally retarded children and to give it to the people that are blind. This is what was suggested from this finding of insomnia from beta blockers.
Yeah, well, see, this is one of the things that gets confusing. Do I recommend melatonin as a sleeping aid for the general population? No, I don't. Why? Because I think we should solve the problem of why don't you sleep? And when you do that, you're probably going to solve the issue. You won't be needing to take anything to put you to sleep. Again, it's like putting a Band-Aid over something so you can't see it. And you may help with the symptoms, but you're not helping with the underlying problem. So it's like ignoring what's going on. And that's what we do so often in the practice of medicine today, particularly when we use drugs and technologies. Now, there are times when melatonin can be a godsend and the appropriate thing to do. I mean, if you're on a beta blocker, we know that melatonin production is suppressed, so you don't have enough. But you don't need to take a boatload of melatonin to solve that problem. You take the smallest dose that you can find and maybe take that at bedtime, and then only when you need it. That might be sensible. But what's interesting about melatonin is this study that was done in Neurobiology of Aging, okay, a journal in September of 2012, that showed that if you combine melatonin with exercise in mice, you could actually reduce the rate of progression of Alzheimer's disease in mice that have the Alzheimer's genes that predispose them to getting Alzheimer. So what they did is they studied three different groups of mice. One, they just allowed them to exercise at will. The second group, they gave melatonin alone. And the third, they gave both to. And then they evaluated them at 6 months and saw what the level of Alzheimer's progression was. And the mice that had both melatonin and exercise, there was a synergistic effect that reduced the amount of Alzheimer's progression that was there. So that gives us some hope.
Well, it improved their behavior and their learning and their memory.
Yeah, all big things.
And it protected their brains from oxidative stress. And they found that it's helpful for Lou Gehrig's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and muscular dystrophy, and that it also worked as an anti-inflammatory and an antioxidant.
Yeah.
So this is a good thing about melatonin combined with exercise for people that, you know, have Alzheimer's or a tendency to have Alzheimer's. But to take it across the board?
Well, no, that's right. And even to use it for these conditions, I think should be supervised by a physician that understands nutritional medicine and also understands these diseases. Because you don't want just across the board start telling people who have a whole bunch of different kinds of illnesses to start taking melatonin.
Well, they also mentioned that to take it with exercise. So
yeah, that's right. That's
a lot
the
of
big
these
key.
Older people are not going to be exercising enough.
Well, in Alzheimer's, it's really important to exercise, to stay mentally active, to be socially active, because it slows down the progression of the disease. But when you're talking about doses of melatonin and when to use them and when not to, what we have is an example of cancer. I mean, there are some people, some doctors who have treated their patients with cancer with massive doses of melatonin because it seems to have a powerful antioxidant, anti-inflammatory effect that may slow down the progression of metastases and maybe even help set back the cancer. But there you're talking about taking 20 milligrams a day. So what,
just under the supervision of your practitioner, healthcare practitioner.
Yeah, that's really important to do. So it's interesting that we have all this information about melatonin, and the question is how do you know when to do what? And that's the real issue. On our own, we read these direct-to-consumer ads, and we get the idea that almost anything is the right thing to do. But in actuality, it takes a lot of experience and knowledge. Or at the end of the show, and I want to remind you that we'll be back live to talk about what's new in the news and health and to take your health questions every Monday morning on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 10 to 11 Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for health will also be available 24/7 on DrSaputo.com as well as PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on DrSaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a great week. See you next time.